claim ownership when the work was included in a book of his poetry. He came from a prominent family. His father was Benjamin Moore, who was the Bishop of New York. He is famous for officiating at the inauguration of George Washington. "'Twas the Night Before Christmas," by Clement C. Moore. "'Twas the night before Christmas, when all through the house not a creature was stirring, not even a mouse. The stockings were hung by the chimney with care, in hopes that St. Nicholas soon would be there. The children were nestled all snug in their beds, while visions of sugar plums danced in their heads, and Mama in her kerchief and I in my cap had just settled our brains for a long winter's nap. When out on the lawn there arose such a clatter, I sprang from the bed to see what was the matter. Away to the window I flew like a flash, tore open the shutters and threw up the sash. The moon on the breast of the new-fallen snow gave the luster of midday to objects below, when what to my wondering eyes should appear but a miniature sleigh and eight tiny reindeer, with a little old driver so lively and quick, I knew in a moment it must be St. Nick. More rapid than eagles his coursers they came, and he whistled and shouted and called them by name. Now Dasher, now Dancer, now Prancer and Vixen, on Comet, on Cupid, on Donner and Blitzen. To the top of the porch, to the top of the wall, now dash away, dash away, dash away all. As dry leaves that before the wild hurricane fly, when they meet with an obstacle mount to the sky, so up to the housetop the coursers they flew, with a sleigh full of toys and St. Nicholas too. And then in a twinkling I heard on the roof the prancing and pawing of each little hoof. As I drew in my head and was turning around, down the chimney St. Nicholas came with a bound. He was dressed all in fur from his head to his foot, and his clothes were all tarnished with ashes and soot. A bundle of toys he had flung on his back, and he looked like a peddler just opening his pack. His eyes, how they twinkled! His dimples, how merry! His cheeks were like roses, his nose like a cherry. His droll little mouth was drawn up like a bow, and the beard of his chin was as white as the snow. The stump of a pipe he held tight in his teeth, and the smoke, it encircled his head like a wreath. He had a broad face, and a little round belly that shook when he laughed, like a bowlful of jelly. He was chubby and plump, a right jolly old elf, and I laughed when I saw him, in spite of myself. A wink of his eye and a twist of his head soon gave me to know I had nothing to dread. He spoke not a word, but went straight to his work, and filled all the stockings, then turned with a jerk, and laying his finger aside of his nose, and giving a nod, up the chimney he rose. He sprang away to his sleigh, to his team gave a whistle, and they all flew away like the down of a thistle. But I heard him exclaim, ere he drove out of sight, "Happy Christmas to all, and to all a good night."
Stave 4, A Christmas Carol by Charles Dickens. Stave 4, The Last of the Spirits. The phantom slowly, gravely, silently approached. It was shrouded in a deep black garment which concealed its head, its face, its form, and left nothing of it visible save one outstretched hand. Its mysterious presence filled him with a solemn dread. The spirit neither spoke nor moved. "I am in the presence of the ghost of Christmas yet to come?" The spirit answered not, but pointed onward with its hand. "You are about to show me shadows of the things that have not happened, but will happen in the time before us. Is that so, spirit?" The upper portion of the garment was contracted for an instant in its folds, as if the spirit had inclined its head. That was the only answer he received. Although well used to ghostly company by this time, Scrooge feared the silent shape so much that his legs trembled beneath him. He could see nothing but a spectral hand and one great heap of black. "Ghost of the future, I fear you more than any specter I have seen, but as I know your purpose is to do me good, and as I hope to live to be another man from what I was, I am prepared to bear you company and do it with a thankful heart. Will you not speak to me?" It gave him no reply. The hand was pointed straight before them. "Lead on. Lead on, spirit." Scrooge followed. The spirit stopped beside one little knot of businessmen. Observing that the hand was pointed to them, Scrooge advanced to listen to their talk. "No, I don't know much about it either way. I only know he's dead."
"When did he die?"
"Last night, I believe."
"Why, what was the matter with him? I thought he'd never die."
"What has he done with his money?"
"Oh, I haven't heard. Left it to his company, perhaps. He hasn't left it to me, that's all I know."
This pleasantry was received with a general laugh. "It's likely to be a very cheap funeral, for upon my life I don't know of anybody to go to it. Suppose we make up a party and volunteer."
"Oh, I don't mind going if lunch is provided."
Another laugh. "Well, I am the most disinterested among you after all, but I'll offer to go if anybody else will. When I come to think of it, I'm not at all sure that I wasn't his most particular friend, for we used to stop and speak whenever we met. Bye-bye." Speakers and listeners strolled away and mixed with other groups. Scrooge knew the men and looked towards the spirit for an explanation. Scrooge was at first inclined to be surprised that the spirit should attach importance to conversations apparently so trivial. They could scarcely be supposed to have any bearing on the death of Jacob, his old partner, for that was past, and this ghost's province was the future. Nor could he think of anyone immediately connected with himself to whom he could apply them. He looked about, in that very place, for his own image, but he saw no likeness of himself among the multitudes. Quiet and dark, beside him stood the phantom, with its outstretched hand. Scrooge fancied the unseen eyes were looking at him keenly. It made him shudder and feel very cold. They left the busy scene and went into an obscure part of the town where Scrooge recognized its situation and its bad repute. The ways were foul and narrow, the shops and houses wretched. Far in this den of infamous resort, there was a shop where iron, old rags, bottles, bones, and greasy offal were bought. Upon the floor within were piled up heaps of rusty keys, nails, chains, hinges, files, scales, weights, and refuge iron of all kinds. Sitting among the wares he dealt in was a gray-haired rascal, nearly 70 years of age. Scrooge and the Phantom came into the presence of this man just as a woman with a heavy bundle slunk into the shop. But she had scarcely entered when another woman came in too, and she was closely followed by a man in faded black, who was no less startled by the sight of them than they had been upon the recognition of each other. After a short period of blank astonishment, they all three burst into a laugh.
"Let the charwoman alone to be the first," cried she who had entered first. "Let the laundress alone to be second, and let the undertaker's man alone to be the third. Look here, old Joe, here's a chance if we haven't all three met here without meaning it."
"Oh, you couldn't have met in a better place," said old Joe,
removing his pipe from his mouth.
come into the parlour. You were made free of it long ago, you know, and the other two ain't strangers. What have you got to sell? What have you got to sell? What odds, then? What odds, Mrs. Dilber? Every person has a right to take care of themselves. He always did. That's enough. Who's the worst for a loss of a few things like these? Not a dead man, I suppose. If he wanted to keep him after he was dead, a wicked old screw, why, he wasn't natural. Why wasn't he natural in his lifetime? If he had been, he'd have had somebody to look after him when he was struck with death, instead of lying, gasping out his last there, alone by himself. It's the truest word that was ever spoke. It's a judgment on him. I wish it was a little heavier, and it should have been. You may depend upon it, if I could have laid my hands on anything else. Open that bundle, old Joe. Let me know the value of it. Speak out plain. I'm not afraid to be the first, nor afraid for them to see it. Oh, open the bundle, Joe. I always give too much to the ladies. It's a weakness of mine, and that's the way I ruin myself. Joe went down on his knees for the greater convenience of opening the bundle and dragged out a large and heavy roll of some dark stuff. What do you call this? Bed curtains? Ah, bed curtains. You don't mean to say you took them down, rings and all, with him lying there? Why, oh, yes, I do. Why not? Don't drop that oil up on the blankets now. His blankets? Whose else do you think? Replied the woman. Isn't likely to take cold without him, I dare say. I hope he didn't die of anything catching, eh? Said old Joe, stopping in his work and looking up. Ah, you may look through that shirt till your eyes ache, but you won't find a hole in it, nor a threadbare place. It's the best he had, and a fine one, too. They'd have wasted it if it hadn't been for me. What do you call wasting of it? Putting it on him to be buried in, for sure. To be sure, somebody was fool enough to do it, but I took it off again. Scrooge listened to this dialogue in horror. This is the end of it, you see. He frightened away everyone from him when he was alive to profit us when he was dead. Spirit, I see the case of this unhappy man might be my own. My life tends that way now. Merciful heaven, what is this? He recoiled in terror, for the scene had changed, and now he almost touched a bed, a bare, uncurtained bed. A pale light rising in the outer air fell straight upon the bed, and on it, unwatched, unwept, uncared for, was the body of this plundered man.
AM 630, K-Talk. Honest talk, serious solutions.
So are you coming with me or not?
No.
Do you ever find that someone else's drinking is affecting your life? Does it ever make you feel angry?
Don't yell at me because you're mad at your mom. She's the drunk, not me.
Do you ever feel depressed or sorry for yourself?
I'm going to have to cancel tonight, John. Sorry, but Tanya's drinking again. Yeah, maybe next time.
Or does it sometimes make you feel frightened?
Why are you cooking again? Just eat, okay? Then get your rooms picked up. I don't want any trouble when Dad gets home.
No matter how you feel, if someone's drinking is affecting your life, we can help. We're Al-Anon family groups, and we know what it's like. To locate an Al-Anon or Alateen group in your community, call 1-888-4-ALANON or visit our website at alanon.alateen.org.
Why does Daddy have to drink so much?
Remember, to help them,
I don't know, honey.
You have to help yourself first.
Investors, today's economic and political instability means it's more important than ever for you to create financial protection and upside potential. How can you do it? With an investment in gold. I'm Mark Alberian, president of Goldline. the nation's trusted source for gold and silver since 1960. Our clients have seen gold and silver more than double in the last 3 years, and many experts are predicting even greater increases. We make it easy for you to add gold and silver to your portfolio for as little as $1,000. I'm talking about real gold and silver, shipped to you with no sales tax or delivery fees. Find out how gold can protect you from inflation, a falling dollar, and world unrest. Call Goldline right now, and I'll send you a free investor's kit and CD. Call 1-800-TAP-GOLD, 1-800-TAP-GOLD. Call Goldline right now for your free investor kit and CD, 1-800-TAP-GOLD, 1-800-TAP-GOLD.
Charles Dickens, A Christmas Carol. Scrooge glanced towards the phantom. A steady hand was pointed to the head. The cover was so carelessly adjusted that the slightest raising of it, the motion of a finger upon Scrooge's part, would have disclosed the face.
"Spirit," he said, "this is a fearful place. In leaving it, I shall not leave its lesson, trust me. Let us go."
Still the ghost pointed with an unmoved finger to the head.
I understand you, and I would uncover this corpse if I could. But I have not the power, Spirit. I have not the power."
Again it seemed to look upon him.
"Spirit, I beseech you, let me see some tenderness connected with a death or this dark chamber. Let me see some tenderness connected with a death or this dark chamber will forever be present to me."
The ghost conducted him to poor Bob Cratchit's house, the dwelling he had visited before, and found the mother and the children seated round the fire. Quiet. Very quiet. The noisy little Cratchits were as still as statues in one corner, and sat looking up at Peter, who had a book before him. The mother and her daughters were engaged in needlework. But surely they were very quiet.
"And he took a child and set him in the midst of them."
Where had Scrooge heard those words? He had not dreamed them. The boy must have read them out as he and the spirit crossed the threshold. Why did he not go on? The mother laid her work upon the table and put her hand up to her face.
"The color hurts my eyes," she said.
"The color? Ah, poor Tiny Tim."
"They're better again now. It makes them weak by candlelight, and I wouldn't show weak eyes to your father when he comes home for the world. It must be near his time."
"Past it, rather," Peter answered, shutting up his book. "But I think he has walked a little slower than he used these last few evenings, Mother.
I have known him to walk with... I have known him to walk with Tiny Tim upon his shoulder very fast indeed."
"And so have I," cried Peter. "Often."
"And so have I," exclaimed another.
So had all.
"But he was very light to carry, and his father loved him so... it was no trouble.
No trouble.
And there is your father at the door."
She hurried out to meet him, and little Bob in his comforter, he had need of it, poor fellow, came in. His tea was ready for him on the hob, and they all tried who should help him to it most. Then the two young Cratchits got upon his knees and laid each child a little cheek against his face, as if they said,
"Don't mind it, Father. Don't be grieved."
Bob was very cheerful with them and spoke pleasantly to all the family. He looked at the needlework upon the table and praised the industry and speed of Mrs. Cratchit and the girls. "They would be done long before Sunday," he said.
"Sunday? You went today then, Robert?"
Yes, my dear, returned Bob. I wish you could have gone. It would have done you good to see how green a place it is. But you'll see it often. I promised him that I would walk there on a Sunday. My little, little child. My little child. He broke down all at once. He couldn't help it. However, and whenever we part from one another, I am sure we shall none of us forget poor Tiny Tim, shall we? Or this first parting that there was amongst us, that there was among us. Never, father, cried they all. And I know, said Bob, I know, my dears, that when we recollect how patient and how mild he was, although he was a little, little child, we shall not quarrel easily among ourselves and forget poor Tiny Tim in doing it. No, never, father, they all cried again. I am very happy. I am very happy. Spectre, said Scrooge, something informs me that our parting moment is at hand. I know it, but I know not how. Tell me what man that was whom we saw lying dead. The ghost of Christmas, yet to come, conveyed him as before to a dismal, wretched, ruinous churchyard. The spirit stood among the graves and pointed down to one. Before I draw nearer to that stone to which you point, answer me one question. Are these the shadows of the things that will be, or are they shadows of things that may be only? Still, the ghost pointed downward to the grave by which it stood. Men's courses will foreshadow certain ends to which, if persevered in, they must lead. But if the courses be departed from, the ends will change. Say it is thus with what you show me. The spirit was immovable as ever. Scrooge crept towards it, trembling as he went, and following the finger, read upon the stone of the neglected grave his own name, Ebenezer Scrooge. Am I that man who lay upon the bed? No, spirit, oh, no, no, spirit, hear me. I am not the man I was. I will not be the man I must have been but for your intercession. Why, show me this, if I am past all hope. Good spirit, your nature intercedes for me and pities me. Assure me that I may yet change these shadows you have shown me by an altered life. For the first time, the kind hand faltered. I will honor Christmas in my heart and try to keep it all the year. I will live in the past, the present, and the future. The spirits of all three shall strive within me. I will not shut out the lessons that they teach. Oh, tell me I may sponge away the writing on this stone. Holding up his hands in a last prayer to have his fate reversed, he saw an alteration in the phantom's hood and dress. It shrunk, collapsed, and dwindled down into a bedpost. Yes, the bedpost was his own. The bed was his own. The room was his own. Best and happiest of all, the time before him was his own to make amends in. I will live in the past, the present, and the future. The spirits of all three shall strive within me. Oh, Jacob Marley, heaven in the Christmas time be praised for this. I say it on my knees, old Jacob, on my knees. He was so fluttered and so glowing with his good intentions that his broken voice would scarcely answer to his call. He had been sobbing violently in his conflict with the spirit, and his face was wet with tears. I don't know what to do. I am as light as a feather. I am as happy as an angel. I am as merry as a schoolboy. I am as giddy as a drunken man. A Merry Christmas to everybody. A Happy New Year to all the world. Hello there. Hello. He had frisked into the sitting room and was now standing there perfectly winded. There's the door by which the ghost of Jacob Marley entered. There's the corner where the ghost of Christmas Past sat. There's the window where I saw the wandering spirits. It's all right. It's all true. It all happened. Really, for a man who had been out of practice for so many years, it was a splendid laugh. A most illustrious laugh. the father of a long line of brilliant laughs. "I don't know what day of the month it is," said Scrooge. I don't know how long I've been among the spirits. I don't know anything." Running to the window, he opened it and put out his head. "What's today?" cried Scrooge, calling downward to a boy in Sunday clothes. "Eh? What's today, my fine fellow?" "Today," replied the boy, "why, Christmas Day." "Oh, it's Christmas Day. I haven't missed it. The spirits have done it all in one night. They can do anything they like. Of course they can. Of course they can. Hello, my fine fellow." "Hello. Do you know the poulterers in the next street but one at the corner?" "Oh, I should hope I did." "An intelligent boy, a remarkable boy. Do you know whether they've sold the prize turkey that was hanging up there? Not the little prize turkey, the big one."
"What? The one as big as me?"
"Oh, what a delightful boy. It's a pleasure to talk to him. Yes, my buck."
"It's hanging there now."
"Is it? Go and buy it."
"What?"
"No, no, I am in earnest. Go and buy it and tell them to bring it here, that I may give them the direction where to take it. Come back with the man and I'll give you a shilling. Come back with him in less than 5 minutes and I'll give you half a crown." The boy was off like a shot. "I'll send it to Bob Cratchit's. He shan't know who sends it. It's twice the size of Tiny Tim." The hand in which he wrote the address was not a steady one, but write it he did somehow, and went downstairs to the open street door, ready for the coming of the poulterer's man. "Here's the turkey. Hello! How are you? Merry Christmas!" It was a turkey. He never could have stood upon his legs, that bird. He would have snapped them short off in a minute, like sticks of sealing wax. Scrooge dressed himself all in his best, and at last got out into the streets. The people were by this time pouring forth, as he had seen them with the Ghost of Christmas Present, and walking with his hands behind him. Scrooge regarded every one with a delighted smile. He looked so irresistibly pleasant that three or four good-humored fellows said, "Good morning, sir. A Merry Christmas to you." And Scrooge said, often afterwards, that of all the blithe sounds he had ever heard, those were the blithest in his ears. He had never dreamed that any walk could give him so much happiness. He went to church and walked about the streets and watched the people hurrying to and fro and patted children on the head and questioned beggars. He never dreamed that any walk, that anything could give him so much happiness. In the afternoon, he turned his steps towards his nephew's house. He passed the door a dozen times before he had the courage to go up and knock. But he made a dash and did it. "Is your master at home, my dear?" said Scrooge to the girl. "Nice girl, very."
"Yes, sir."
"Where is he, my love?"
"He's in the dining room, sir, along with mistress. I'll show you upstairs, if you please."
"Oh, thank you. He knows me," said Scrooge, with his hand already on the dining room lock. "Fred!"
"Why, bless my soul," cried Fred. "Who's that?"
"It's I, your Uncle Scrooge. I have come to dinner. Will you let me in, Fred?"
Let him in. It's a mercy he didn't shake his arm off. He was at home in 5 minutes. Nothing could be heartier. Wonderful party, wonderful games, wonderful unanimity, wonderful happiness.
But he was early at the office next morning. Oh, he was early there. If he could only be there first and catch Bob Cratchit coming late. That was the thing he had set his heart upon. And he did it. Yes, he did.
9. No Bob.
9:15. No Bob. He was full 18 minutes and a half behind his time. Scrooge sat with his door wide open that he might see him come into the tank. Bob's hat was off before he opened the door, and his comfort or two, he was on his stool in a jiffy, driving away with his pen, as if he were trying to overtake 9 o'clock. "Hello," growled Scrooge in his accustomed voice, as near as he could feign it. "What do you mean by coming here at this time of day?"
"Ah, I'm very sorry, sir. I am behind my time."
"You are, yes. I think you are. Step this way, sir, if you please."
It's only once a year, sir.
It shall not be repeated. I was making rather merry yesterday, sir.
Now I'll tell you what, my friend. I am not going to stand this sort of thing any longer. And therefore...
Scrooge continued, leaping from his stool and giving Bob such a dig in the waistcoat that he staggered back into the tank again.
And therefore, I am about to raise your salary. Merry Christmas, Bob, said Scrooge with an earnestness that could not be mistaken, as he clapped him on the back.
A merrier Christmas, Bob, my good fellow, than I have given you for many a year. I'll raise your salary and endeavor to assist your struggling family, and we will discuss your affairs this very afternoon. Bob, make up the fires, and buy another coal shuttle before you dot another I, Bob Cratchit.
Scrooge was better than his word. He did it all, and infinitely more, and to Tiny Tim, who did not die, he was a second father. He became as good a friend, as good a master, and as good a man as the good old city knew, or any other good old city, town, or borough in the good old world. Some people laughed to see the alteration in him, but he let them laugh, and little heeded them, for he was wise enough to know that nothing ever happened on this globe for good, at which some people did not have their fill of laughter in the outset, and knowing that such as these would be blind anyway, he thought it quite as well that they should wrinkle up their eyes in grins. His own heart laughed, and that was quite enough for him. He had no further interactions with spirits, and it was always said of him that he knew how to keep Christmas well, if any man alive possessed the knowledge. May that be truly said of us, and all of us. And so, as Tiny Tim observed, God bless us, everyone. Thank you for bearing with me as we redid A Christmas Carol. It's going to be available online before Christmas if you'd like to share it with your family. Go to DaneAllred.com.
AM 630, K-Talk, Utah's independent radio voice for 45 years.
I am the port in the storm.
I am the line in the sand.
I am the rescuer in the dark.
I am the enforcer of the seas.
I am the defender of the homeland.
In the United States Coast Guard and Coast Guard Reserve, you are the first line of defense against threats to our American way of life. To become one of us, call 1-877-NOW-USCG or visit GoCoastGuard.com.
We are the shield of freedom. We are the United States Coast Guard.
Sponsored by the U.S. Coast Guard in cooperation with the Utah Broadcasters Association and this station.
Dane Allred's World of Hurt, St. George Groanings. If you've ever had the occasion to run a marathon, if you ever have the occasion to run a marathon, I would suggest you run the St. George Marathon. It's an incredible adventure and really, really fun. It seems like the entire city shows up to cheer you on, and the course is spectacular. Racers are asked to gather at 6 a.m. in downtown St. George, and it is a strange sight to see people in running shorts and sweats gathered in October that early in the morning. It really looks like a lot of ghosts floating toward the same destination. They load you up on buses and drive you out to the starting line, 26.2 miles away. As you're riding out on the bus, you can look around and see people older, younger, fatter, and thinner than you. You get to wonder who will make it. People talk about other races they have done. If this is their first marathon, most of us look scared. The bad news about being transported to the starting line is that you realize as you travel for 45 minutes that you have to run the entire way back. And you start wondering how much farther the bus will go. The farther the bus goes, the farther you'll have to run. In my second and third marathons, I realized it was better to distract yourself somehow rather than consider the distance the bus was traveling. When you reach the beginning of the race up Snow Canyon, you are a mile and a half higher than when you boarded the bus. That is both good and bad. At least you are running mostly downhill. During the next week, I will feel it in the bottom of my knees. At the starting line, there are massive fires burning at the side of the road. Music plays and porta-potties line the way. There are thousands of similarly crazy runners huddled around the fires, since it's about 40 degrees or less outside. After a mile or two, the temperature will feel great, but the race people do their best to keep you toasty before the race. Around the communal fire, the passion of running sparkles in the eyes of those who gathered, If you've worn sweats, they allow you to bag them up and put your number on them. Then they don't have to gather thousands of pieces of clothing along the 26-mile course, since runners tend to shed clothing without a thought when they start heating up. You throw your bag in the back of a big rider truck, and the hundreds of bags are transported to the finish line and stacked by number on the tennis courts. Then the race begins, and if you've listened to instructions and followed the signs, you line up by the time you expect to finish. This avoids crowding the starting line, and when you're going to run for hours, being back from the starting line is not so bad. It might be 3 minutes before you even see the starting line after the gun, if you run as slowly as I. And what's 3 minutes spread over 4 hours anyway? Most of us don't start our watches until we cross the starting line anyway. That explains how our unofficial times are slower than the officially listed finishing time. We want the fast runners to get out of the way so we can concentrate on the rest of the course. The only good advice I can give about running I learned from reading a jogging book, and it seems to work no matter what race I'm running. There's a volcano called Veo in the first part of the race, which means we'll be running uphill for a while. I run so slow uphill, it may be mistaken for a stroll. I may be the only one who knows I'm still running, which can be evidenced by my continually pumping knees, but I am not walking. I am running very, very slowly. The hill usually kills most of us, but the secret to the hill is on the other side. We tend to have an established pace when we run on level ground, and most people keep up this pace on the downside of a hill. But the advantage of gravity can give you a great boost when you're running a race. It doesn't take as much effort to run downhill, so most people rest on the downhill. One of the greatest feelings in the world is to be doing well while others are struggling. With this technique, you really aren't running faster, just taking bigger steps. It may be a small difference, but maybe what is eluding most of us is keeping up the same pace, but just taking bigger steps.
Thank you.
Literature Out Loud, Sonnet 81 by William Shakespeare. Or I shall live your epitaph to make, or you survive when I in earth am rotten. From hence your memory death cannot take, although in me each part will be forgotten. Your name from hence immortal life shall have, though I, once gone, to all the world must die. The earth can yield me but a common grave, when you, entombed in men's eyes, shall lie. Your monument shall be my gentle verse, which eyes not yet created shall o'erread, and tongues to be your being shall rehearse, when all the breathers of this world are dead. You still shall live, such virtue hath my pen, where breath most breathes, even in the mouths of men. Literature Out Loud, Sonnet 82 by William Shakespeare. I grant thou wert not married to my muse, and therefore mayest without a taint or look the dedicated words which writers use of their fair subject, blessing every book thou art as fair in knowledge as in hue, finding thy worth a limit past my praise, and therefore art enforced to seek anew some fresher stamp of the time-bettering days, and do so, love. Yet, when they have devised what strained touches rhetoric can lend, thou truly fair wert truly sympathized in true plain words by thy true-telling friend. And their gross painting might be better used, where cheeks need blood. In thee it is abused. Literature Out Loud, Sonnet 83 by William Shakespeare. I never saw that you did painting need, and therefore to your fair no painting set. I found, or thought I found, you did exceed the barren tender of a poet's debt, and therefore have I slept in your report, that you yourself being extant might well show how far a modern quill doth come too short. Speaking of worth, what worth in you doth grow? This silence for my sin you did impute, which shall be most my glory, being dumb. For I impair not beauty, being mute, when others would give life and bring a tomb. There lives more life in one of your fair eyes than both your poets can in praise devise. Literature Out Loud, Sonnet 84 by William Shakespeare. Who is it that says most? Which can say more than this rich praise, that you alone are you? In whose confine immured is the store, which should example where your equal grew? Lean penury within that pen doth dwell, that to his subject lends not some small glory. But he that writes of you, if he can tell that you are you, so dignifies his story, let him but copy what in you is writ, not making worse what nature made so clear, and such a counterpart shall fame his wit, making his style admired everywhere. You, to your beauteous blessings add a curse, being fond on praise, which makes your praises worse. Literature Out Loud, Sonnet 85 by William Shakespeare. My tongue-tied muse in manners holds her still, while comments of your praise, richly compiled, reserve their character with golden quill and precious phrase by all the muses filed. I think good thoughts whilst others write good words, and like unlettered clerk, still cry amen to every hymn that able spirit affords in polished form of well-refined pen. Hearing you praised, I say, 'tis so, 'tis true, and to the most of praise add something more. But that is in my thought, whose love to you, the words come hindmost, holds his rank before, than others for the breath of words respect, me for my dumb thoughts, speaking in effect. Bright Space by Dane Allred. Our Journey. I hope you are finding out those things you were sent here to discover. Achieving those things only you can do. Finding those opportunities to reconnect with everyone in this world who was with us in the bright space. We were sent here to learn all there is to know, to return and complete the knowledge we sought when we left the bright space. We knew we could only learn these things alone and apart from each other here on a spinning planet. We had to leave the perfect piece of the bright space to find the answers this universe is seeking by manifesting itself in you and me. Thank you.
Your life is so different from mine, even though we seem to spin in the same orbits, doing similar things, finding similar answers, reaching similar conclusions. But you are a unique expression of how this universe wants to learn. Your experiences add to the combined experiences of all who have ever lived, are living now, and are yet to live. When that reunion of all of us in the bright space takes place, what a wonderful gathering it will be. We will understand how our experiences and the experiences of others have fulfilled our wish to know all there is to know. To experience those things only we could experience, in a way only we could understand. We are reminded of that elusive goal every time we meet someone who we are sure we've already met. We were together in the bright space before this life, and the promises we made to each other are fulfilled on those days when we reach out to that other person, reminded of how important this life really is, reminded of how important that other person really is, reminded that we have a work to do that only we can do. We glimpse the majesty of this work to bring us together again in that bright space. Together, we can see into the future of our universe. Hide and Seek by Dane Allred. Lurking just out of sight, I can't quite tell where. Hiding and waiting, I know it is there for an opportunity to surprise me. That elusive enemy that always wins by his surprise attack. Waiting so patiently, I forget to be on my guard, forget to anticipate his assault. It happens every time. No matter how I prepare or oaths I make to be unsurprised this time, I'll just walk nonchalantly through this field and pretend I don't know what is coming next. I'll calmly face this next attack. Quick! Get this grasshopper off my back!